You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hi, and welcome to a Times Higher Education special podcast edition for the Higher Education Review, which was announced by Prime Minister Theresa May on February 19th. I'm Sarah Custer, and I'm here with Simon Baker, Jack Grove, and Chris Havergal to go over the response to the announcement of the Higher Education Review. So, Simon, you're up in Derby for the announcement.
Yeah, which was very interesting and at the same time felt a little bit like Groundhog Day because I covered the Brown Review a few years ago and I didn't really think that we'd be at this point quite so soon. But a significant thing about yesterday was that the Prime Minister tried to kind of make clear that this was not a review of universities only, it was about all of post-18 education, and so it was deliberately hosted at an FE college rather than a university. The speech was kind of three quarters of it was really about trying to get rid of what she called false boundaries between higher education and further education and making sure that every, you know, not just the 50% that go to university, but the other half that don't have an option of a route into technical education, and also suggesting that maybe not kind of every person that goes to university should be going to university, whether they're, and that's depending on whatever background they're from, whether it's even those that are privately educated and they're expected to go to the university, they should be able to choose a more technical route without feeling like that's kind of some kind of failure. I think that was kind of the point of the speech. What's notable though is that although that was the kind of speech, that wasn't the story. The story and what the media are kind of absolutely obsessed with really when it comes to this issue is tuition fees. Tuition fees is a toxic issue. It's been going on for years. You know, they slowly went up. Now Labour have got a kind of pledge to scrap them. They won lots of votes in the election. A lot of people think because of that. So now it's all about the politics of trying to sort of detoxify tuition fees as an issue, finding a way out of this quagmire we seem to be in where fees, not only about fees, but the system is going to become increasingly unsustainable potentially in the future because as the debts are written off, then more and more money comes back into the kind of onto the balance sheet of the government. So it's incredible that we're kind of here already. Although it's quite interesting, some of the members of the panel, because you've got Alison Wolfe on there, who is an academic that has written quite in quite a lot of detail about how there needs to be a rebalancing of the education system away from just universities and more towards FE. And the big problem is that kind of fees have enabled universities to kind of still get a large amount of income. At the same time, FE colleges have been the funding has just been completely cut. So if you're going to fix this problem, then you need to talk about how you're going to fund everything at the end of the day. So the review obviously does have stuff in there about how they look at the repayment system and the actual system of tuition fees. And they're saying everything's on the table apart from scrapping, they're going to sort of no fees. But one thing I wonder sometimes is the one way that potentially you could see out of this sort of mess that I think we're in now is will they look at a graduate tax again? Because if you completely took away the sticker price idea of tuition fees having a set fee on every degree and you found a way to turn it into more of an Australian model where all students see is that they can make a contribution afterwards and they don't have this debt figure and this, because essentially it is a bit of a graduate tax system now, but you have to kind of, it's about the communication of that, and that's just gone badly wrong.
Messaging.
Interesting to see yesterday Justine Greening, who's the former education secretary, moving towards advocating a graduate tax, suggesting that what she describes as a higher education fund should be created, just like we use sort of national insurance to fund things like the NHS. She was suggesting that graduates could pay into this fund on, you know, sounded like pretty similar terms to what they do at the moment. 9% of their salary over £25,000 is what it is currently. So it's interesting to see her say that. But, you know, the fact is that she was the education secretary previously and was moved out of that job, seemingly for opposing some of the more bigger ideas that it would seem that, you know, Theresa May is more keen on the ideas of sort of, you know, cutting fees, big changes to interest rates and things like that. So the fact that she's had to advocate that position outside of government might suggest to some people that it's not, you know, graduate tax isn't the way they're going to go this time.
And she was recently ousted less than a month ago.
It's an extraordinary situation that you've got, like, the former education secretary who has just been pushed out of a job partly because she didn't want a review into this and thought it, and she said this weekend she wanted action to be taken straight away, really, rather than reviewing it, is now already briefing against, like, the government. It's just, I mean, that just sort of tells you everything you need to know about the paralysis that we have in this country politically at the moment, really.
Now, Simon, you spoke with the new universities minister for the first time yesterday as well, Sam Gyimah.
Yeah. So I managed to get a quick chat with him afterwards, and I kind of asked him more about some of the other technical aspects of the review when it comes to higher education. You know, what would happen if they reduce fees for some courses. Would that just mean poor students would opt not to go to university? He kind of dodged that one, really, and talked about, well, we can't preempt the review, that kind of thing. But also, it was interesting to sort of ask him a little bit about the situation with whether they think too many people are going to university, do they think there are too many universities, do you think they should have got rid of polytechnics, that kind of thing.
And you asked the Prime Minister.
The one question she didn't really answer.
yeah, that's true. But he came to the sort of defence of modern universities quite explicitly. When you mentioned that, he sort of said it's a lazy attitude to say that, you know, it's just the Russell Group of the kind of universities that people should go to and that kind of thing. And so he's quite sort of forceful at that point. But then I also kind of asked him whether we're just going to have another review in 5 years' time. And he kind of said, well, if we do have another one, then fine. But I sort of think that's kind of a bit...
Because this does sit in a historical context. I mean, you said that you reported on the Brown Review as well. So yeah. How many higher education reviews have...
Well, I suppose you can argue this one's different because it is looking not just at higher education, but the major higher education reviews were the Robbins Review in the 60s, the Deering Review, which is the first one that kind of ushered in some sort of fee in the 90s, then the Brown Review, which was, again, a kind of a bit of a political, just brought in because the Brown Labour government were on the way out and they saw this sort of issue, you know, a review as a way to deal with it politically. Which then led to sort of 9K fees, even though that wasn't the Brown recommendation, actually. It was for higher fees, but it was for a complicated system of the more you charge students, the more you'll have to pay back to the government. There was a kind of an equity system they didn't go for in the end. And then this one, so there seems to be the time gap between them seems to be getting less and less. And Gyimah was saying that he thought, you know, he said that Brexit was a reason why this is a good time to do the review now, because thinking about kind of the education system in the future. And but, you know, we all know that this is about politics.
Everything goes back to Brexit. So some of the things that they have said could change. So this is going to be a year-long review. They said they're going to go out to public consultation. They're going to come back this time next year. They're going to be looking at tuition fees, obviously, potentially loan repayments. Chris, what are some of the potential outcomes if the changes to loan repayment periods are shortened or tuition fees are dropped? What do you think could actually happen here?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some interesting modelling conducted by London Economics, which looks at some of the potential implications. I mean, sort of two sort of points leap out of it. First is that a lot of the sort of what would appear to be more attractive options on the table, be it abolishing fees, reducing them, reintroducing maintenance grants, it's all very expensive. The government said in the terms of reference for the review that, well, it's indicated there's, you know, very limited extra money available. It says, you know, any recommendations coming out of the review should still contribute to the government's overall plan of reducing the deficit. So, you know, just to throw a couple of figures out there, abolishing fees altogether, I mean, to be fair, they've said they're not going to go that way. That would be about £5 billion per cohort. It's a lot of money. Even if you reduce them to £6,000, you're looking at over £1 billion per cohort. Maintenance grants are slightly cheaper, sort of, you know, £360 million per cohort. So that's, you know, quite possibly the way they would go. I mean, the other thing that leaps out of that modelling is that actually, you know, if you're talking about equity and fairness, which is what Theresa May was talking about yesterday, frequently it's actually from a lot of these changes the highest earning graduates who benefit the most. For example, if you reduced fees to £6,000 for all courses, it would be the highest earning graduates that benefit. Actually, London Economics calculate that the total repayments on loans for students in the bottom five deciles of income would be entirely unchanged. That's because, you know, typically the people in those poorer groups wouldn't be paying off their loans, so the sort of the amount of loan that's left outstanding at the end is sort of academic.
And can I just stop you right there, because I know that we have an international audience, and I'm obviously not from this country, so it might be worth just kind of unpacking a little bit how the loan system works. I mean, presumably the poorer students, they would be unable to pay as much up front, so that means that they would have more to be paying off over the long term. That's why they...
Typically, most students would take out student loans for the entirety of their tuition fees, so they wouldn't be paying anything up front for that. A year or two ago, the government also did away with maintenance grants, and now maintenance loans are available. Those are available sort of by income, so actually you have a situation where it's the poorest students who are taking out those maintenance loans as well as the tuition fee loans, so it's actually the poorest students who are graduating with the highest levels of debt, typically sort of in excess of £50,000 if you add those two loans together. The picture is slightly different on repayments. Clearly, if we look at loans being paid off at 9% of your income in excess of, from April, the figure will be £25,000. Higher earning graduates clearly do pay off their loans more quickly, and although there's sort of a variation on the income scale, clearly, you know, some of those higher earning graduates are paying much more towards their education. The reason for that being that those poorer graduates who have lower earnings post-graduation, they may never earn above £25,000, so they may never repay anything. Or it may be that, seeing that there's a 30-year repayment time period, they'll never get anywhere near paying off the total balance during that 30 years. This is why some of these changes, where you sort of shave money off fees, change the interest rates, because the overall amount of money is still a significant amount of money that you're borrowing, just reducing that amount of money you've borrowed slightly doesn't actually make any difference to the amount you actually physically have to repay over the course of your career, because you're never going to be able to repay the full balance.
So her efforts to try to make education more accessible to the poorest members of society isn't actually going to work necessarily.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the modelling again, you know, there's a number of cases in which that it's the highest earning graduates who benefit, because of this reason that lower earning graduates, you know, typically don't pay off all their loans, so don't actually see any change. What it indicates is that if you really want to change that situation, you need to look at much more radical and more expensive options. The government's already said it's not going to abolish fees. The government's indicated there's little money available. So in sort of real financial terms, it's going to be a challenge. But there's also, I guess, an issue around sort of terminology. We've talked about graduate taxes. There's this issue of the language of debt and loans, and sort of an issue of debt aversion. If you can sort of make students sort of think differently about the money that they're repaying, and rather than thinking of having it sort of something that's hanging over them, something that's sort of a calculated decision, that if they sort of do earn enough, they'll pay it back, and if they don't, they won't. You know, maybe there's a messaging thing there that they can perhaps make more inroads on.
For me, that's just the central.
Sorry. One of the things there about the London Economics figures, one of the things that it doesn't show is that by having all this money funded through loans, it's off the books, it's off the Treasury accounting bill. So even something rather cheap like reintroducing maintenance grants, it would cost about £360 million, but it would add an extra £1.6 billion onto the deficit. So that is a problem.
Anything like that actually costs the government now. That's the difference. Whereas the loan thing,
they'll look at it in 30 years.
That's why they brought it in the first place, is because it wasn't a cost to the government. of today, really, it pushed it down the road. And it was a way of keeping funding universities while at the same time cutting the deficit. The other thing I was going to say, that just agreeing with Chris, really, that for me it seems like the solution is really obvious, and it has been for years. It's like it's all the problem is all political, and it's all about the language of debt. It doesn't matter how sophisticated the system is for repayment and the write-off, that the fact that students have most of their loan written off. If you get a statement through from the student loans company when you're at university and when you finish university saying your debt's tens of thousands of pounds, it's psychologically not great. It doesn't, you know, and most people aren't necessarily going to look at all the small print and the kind of sophisticated level of financial detail of how this works and realising that it's just a tax, really. They're going to think, bloody hell, I've got, you know, tens of thousands of pounds that I've got to pay back.
Burdened by that for their life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's perhaps worth finding that there is sort of one area where, I mean, I don't know whether the consensus extends to the government, but certainly in the sector and among a lot of MPs, there's sort of a growing consensus that a change can and should be made. And that's to do with interest rates on the student loans. Currently, they're at 3% above the retail price index. That leaves you, for many years historically, that was a comparatively low figure. Now, RPI at 3.1%, you have a situation where students are paying 6.1% interest on their loans. There does appear to be sort of a growing recognition that that is, you know, just sort of not really a sensible level of interest for people to be charging, and it's sort of adding significantly to the burden on students, particularly as, you know, interest which is being charged again while they're actually studying as well. So you know, a suggestion that they should move to the consumer price index, which is a lower figure, or just sort of having it effectively 0% on top of RPI, so a much lower rate of interest. That was something that MPs on the Treasury Select Committee advocated in their report, which was published the day before Theresa May's speech. And you'd expect that would be something that the review would look very closely at.
That was another classic example of a policy that kind of probably has sound financial reasons, because what they're trying to do is to stop, in the past, you had a problem where, probably still happens to a certain extent, people who are from well-off backgrounds would take out the loan because it was such a good interest rate, and then they'd invest it. So that was trying to design to stop. I mean, they can't do that at tuition fees anyway, because the money goes to university, but you can do that with a maintenance loan.
Right.
And I think that's designed, one of the reasons for that is to try and stop it. The reality is, as you look at this interest rate compared to interest rates now, at the moment, you think that's just completely out of whack.
So. Just a final point on that, though, and just to demonstrate how much of this is about politics and how much of it is about equity. If you look at the London economics modelling, charging loan interest at the retail price index, again, because this issue of lower earning graduates not paying off the full balance of their loans, you would do that. It would be pretty popular, you'd think. However, for men in the bottom four deciles and women in the bottom eight, total repayments again would be unchanged.
So it sounds like some pretty complicated accounting gymnastics going on. And I think everyone here agrees that a lot of this is more about politicking than actual trying to improve the higher education system. So we have some facts here that have been touted by various politicians around this issue. So we've got one from Sam Jima on Twitter. Chris, I'll throw this over to you. Sam Jima on Twitter has said that he had a large thread of, I think, seven tweets, and one of them said that the current system under the Conservatives has delivered more places with record numbers of disadvantaged students going to uni. Is that true? Maybe not true or false, but misrepresented.
It depends how you look at it. You know, taking it just in those 140 or 280 characters, it's not actually accurate. If you talk about teenagers, there are record numbers of teenagers from disadvantaged backgrounds going to university. And if you talk about full-time students, there are a record number of disadvantaged students taking up full-time places at university. What that statement doesn't take account of is that the current system, as Sam Jima describes it, while it has, particularly with the uncapping of student numbers, while it has led to a sort of big increase in participation at that teenage and full-time level, there's been a complete collapse in part-time study and mature study. There's increasing evidence that the system of tuition fee loans doesn't really work for
mature part-time students who, you know, may typically be at a different stage of their life and, you know, much more wary of taking on additional borrowing. You've seen, you know, significant reduction in part-time study since 2012. And so the numbers of disadvantaged students going to university is actually down by sort of in excess of 10%. However, if you talk about teenagers and full-time, it's up. And again, you know, that sort of statement perhaps reflects how so often in the recent policy debate, people are thinking about 18-year-olds leaving university, sorry, leaving school and going to university full-time rather than that much bigger picture. And, you know, part-time students are very important if we're looking to, you know, reskill the economy, if we're looking to, you know, reduce unemployment. That's clearly an area where this review does need to take a closer look.
And this is a trend that we've seen in higher education systems across the world, with students studying later in life or going back to school to study. So it's not just the traditional, you leave school at 18 and you go into straight into a degree program. Simon, over to you. How about some of the facts that Theresa May said in her speech up in Derby? Universities in England are now better funded than they have been for a generation. What are we considering a generation is?
A sweeping statement. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about 30 years. You're talking about, potentially 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what you mean by kind of which universities you're looking at. Are you looking, you know, are you looking at just the kind of top research intensives? Are you looking at sort of the universities that became universities in 92 after they were polytechnics? I had looked at this in detail in the past by looking at the sort of unit of resource, really, which is a bit of a technical term, but essentially how much money is going into universities per student. But there's all sort of things, you have to decide whether you're including and include research funding. You look at all money going to universities and then just divide it by the number of students, or are you going to just look at the money that's supposed to be for teaching? I mean, it is certainly true that fees, since fees came in 2012, that went sort of up, basically, the amount of money that was going to universities per student. But the years before fees came in, it had been going down quite dramatically, and research funding and in particular has been sort of cut since fees came in. So a lot of people say that what fees has done has been able to kind of also replace the fact that research funding in real terms wasn't going up. So you have to look at it as sort of as a complete picture. It depends what sort of point in the past you pick as well, because in the 80s, you know, there's a real squeeze on the unit of resource there was again in sort of the 90s, which is why the Deering Review came in. And it's all, you basically, I think if you looked at a graph of it, and I kind of haven't got it in front of me, but I'm guessing it sort of would go up and down, because what's happened is as more and more people have gone to university, they've realised that they need to put more funding in the system. It's not like the 60s when they first expanded universities and only a small proportion of the population went to university and you could use general taxation to fund it. As more and more people have gone, you've had to find different ways of funding it, which are kind of politically acceptable a lot of the time. So would that graph go up and down but trend up? Yeah, possibly.
And does it matter what the source of the funding would be, if it's from the government or if it is from tuition fees, which are obviously subsidising a lot more these days than
the I mean, fees from I think basically the sort of tuition fees, domestic tuition fees, they're kind of basically on the whole kind of break even. You get cross subsidies between different subjects, but international fees for overseas students, they definitely help subsidise research, really, because the true cost of research isn't met. So you do have to include research into all of this,
of course.
That's what universities really are. That's the difference between them and sort of FE, for instance.
Okay. How about Chris? In her speech, she also said that abolishing fees would mean the necessary reintroduction of a cap on numbers. Would it be necessary?
I mean, there is a choice for a government there. Government could abolish fees, fund higher education directly, and foot the bill for that. The reality is, in a time when higher education participation is increasing, and you know a lot of the sort of policy drivers still are looking to push more people into higher education, you would have a situation there where the government would be unable to control the cost of its investment in higher education. And, you know, that's a situation governments are typically very uncomfortable with. So there's a choice there. I mean, you can only have to look at Australia, which, like the UK, has a demand-driven system, but where the balance of upfront funding is slightly more over to the government than to students. And just in the last couple of months, they've looked to effectively cap student numbers. You know, what they've done actually is sort of freeze funding from the government side because of that situation where when you have uncapped numbers, the costs do tend to increase. I mean, that does perhaps indicate another thing that the government could choose to do would be to not introduce a cap on numbers, but to leave funding effectively the same. And then you have a situation where universities have a funding cut, even if they maintain their student numbers, let alone increase them. That would seem to be a situation which would be politically unpalatable and very problematic for universities. So I think I think Labour have perhaps tried to dance around this issue, but if you did abolish fees, you most likely would be looking at a numbers cap.
Okay. Another thing that she said in her speech, Simon, was that almost a quarter of students at our research intensive universities come from the 7% of the population who go to private school.
So I did check this one out. I mean, it is broadly right, really, to be honest. The Independent Schools Council say that about 7% of the total number of school children in England go to private school. That rises to sort of 18% of pupils, if you're looking at the UK, over the age of 16. So that 7% figure is right. With research intensive universities, she's clearly talking about the Russell Group before. I think if you look at the Russell Group, I just had a quick look at the median sort of figure for the percentage of private school kids that went to those universities last year, and it's about 21%, but that was the median of all their shares. I think if you actually looked at the total numbers and then looked at the share of private school children in the Russell Group out of their total numbers, I expect it would end up being like that. And obviously the more selective universities there, like Oxbridge, it's verging more, pushing more towards kind of 40% to 50%.
Okay, so this is obviously pointing to a problem that you could argue does exist within higher education in the UK, that it is quite exclusive to a certain level of student.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of classic issue of a problem with a sort of British higher education system and row that's gone on for years. And how can universities do something about that themselves, or is it all about the schools that children go to at the end of the day?
Podcast.
Yeah, that is a massive issue. Like I said, the row is always between, right, so universities do more, or is it just about schools? The fact that if children go to private school, they're more likely to get good A levels. That's just the kind of, that's the debate that you're going to have there.
And this is a point that you make in the piece that you wrote that's on timeshighereducation.com right now, just about how the problem that they're trying to solve can't necessarily be solved at this level of education in terms of access to...
It's just much bigger than that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certainly things that you can do, and I think there has been progress. It's shown in the last few years that, you know, if universities sort of look at contextual information and look at a child's background, prepared to sort of accept A levels that are lower, but look at where they've studied, and that if they can do that kind of thing, then you can make a difference. But you can't solve the whole class issue in this country just by doing that, because there's much more to it than that.
Okay. Jack, over to you. Yes. She also said that England now has one of the most expensive systems of university tuition in the world. Is that true?
That is correct. It's a lot more expensive than mainland Europe, where fees are often free, like in Germany or in the Netherlands, it's about £1,700 a year. France is also pretty minimal. But if you really look at the US and Australia, who are sort of perhaps the biggest players on the global stage with the UK, the fees are perhaps lower. I mean, in the US, there's 20 million students, so lots of different institutions, but their fees range from about $5,000 a year to $50,000 a year, and about an average of about $33,000 a year, which is £25,000 a year. Obviously, they've got lots of a lot more financial support in terms of scholarships and stuff that philanthropic giving and that sort of support, and there's also government support. But so I'd say probably the UK on average is somewhere just below the US and Australia, which where fees are about £11,000 on average. But also in Australia, things differ. So you can, if you're doing medicine, it'll cost about £32,000 a year.
Okay. But it's also important that this is put into a historical context as well, because the reason why fees are so high is because of policy that was introduced by the Conservative government in 2012.
Yeah, well, that was a Conservative Lib Dem government.
Yeah.
And that was a big change, and there was a big protest at the time. But the thing is that the UK has a world-class university system. It's quite expensive to run. The money has to be found somewhere. And the UK is, you know, very strong in that respect, and lots of people want to come here to study. So there's lots of good reasons to support a university system.
There did seem to be a slight sort of irony, though, when the Prime Minister was making statements like that, one of the most expensive systems of university tuition in the world, and seemingly sort of complaining about that when, you know, clearly that is a product of the last two governments, both of which have been conservative led. And again, you know, that's perhaps an indication of how the government is rattled by the success of Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, who, as you know, pledged to abolish fees. Theresa May, they're very much trying to put herself on the side of that sort of, you know, squeezed middle, those parents and families and grandparents, indeed, she referred to, who, you know, are increasingly concerned about levels of student debt.
In the Sunday Times this weekend, current Education Minister Damien Hines came out saying that they were going to lower the fees for certain courses, and this has definitely ruffled quite a few feathers, especially on Twitter. He said that we're going to be getting the mix of skills which are important for our economy, suggesting that maybe STEM degrees are what will be driving long-term economic growth.
Yes.
Is this a fact that we can check? Do you think this is actually the case?
I think the policy that they're sort of driving at seems a bit bizarre, because if you were to make arts and humanities degrees cheaper, then universities would lose a lot of money. And at the moment, they sort of use some of the surplus from those degrees to subsidise higher cost degrees. And there's a sort of complex ecosystem that sort of works quite well, and people are broadly quite happy with. So actually, if you were to if you were to cut the prices of arts degrees, you might have to put up the prices of STEM degrees if that was allowed, and that wouldn't really help. I think vice chancellors will be, and academics and the university community will be quite against this idea, because it would seem to devalue an arts and humanities degree, which everyone agrees is an important part of the UK economy and very important for the long-term success. And the thing is that it's a demand-driven system, so are you going to say you can't do that? Are you going to trample limits on the amount of people doing arts and humanities degrees? There's already a subsidy for science degrees, so it'll be interesting to see what policies come out, because the whole part of it seems quite confused to me.
I mean, on the social mobility point, you risk having a situation where students from poorer backgrounds feel compelled to take arts degrees, which, as Damien Hines says, typically or often some of them lead to lower graduate earnings. So you risk entrenching social inequality there, which would be the exact opposite of what the government says it's trying to do.
And they keep throwing around this term, the fourth industrial revolution, saying they're trying to prepare the new graduates to compete in this world. But we've heard from Google and different tech companies that they're starting to hire students or graduates with humanities degrees. So arguably, students with STEM degrees might not necessarily be the long-term economic, might not offer the long-term economic growth that they're claiming they will.
I mean, you could probably run Twitter with about 100 staff if it was just a straight up science science offer.
We won't check that fact.
There's all these different elements that you need to incorporate, you need a different skill set to bring in, and I wonder, how are so many people working for Facebook, given it's a sort of a technology platform, but there's all these different people with different roles, and they require different skill sets, and the humanities is quite important in that respect.
And more to the point, you know, we know the sort of STEM skills that the economy might need for the next 5 to 10 years. The problem is, in terms of the pace of technological change, we don't actually know what type of coding, what sort of types of sort of AI interfacing skills that, you know, students should be taught if they're going to have careers which last for 30, 40 years. You can, you know, make a very strong argument that actually the sorts of skills that a humanities or social science degree gives you, the sort of communication, the teamwork, the critical thinking, the ability to form an argument, and the sort of all-round mental agility that those sorts of courses offer you, could well set you up better for the long term than a particularly sort of applied and focused area of science, technology or engineering.
Should we have a full disclosure? Are we all humanities graduates at this table?
Yes.
Yep. and social science, I guess. Economics and politics.
All right, important to make that point. So I guess finally, Jack, you've spoken to some people, some university stakeholders. What's been the response?
Well, I think they're very against this idea of differentiating tuition fees, because that would sort of undermine the sort of cohesion of the university, the community. It would sort of segment and segregate disciplines and subjects, and so that's one thing. There's also big risk in terms, there's big worries about cuts in fundings and fewer resources in universities caused by this review, and lots of people can't really, beyond the sort of 6.1% interest rate, which could be fixed quite easily, lots of people are really sort of struggling to see why this is such a big problem. What, you know, the funding seems to be working, more students are going to university. It's a political problem, and it just needs a sort of political fix, which most people can sort of see what needs to be done. And also, this review may not even help Theresa May. It may just open up, everybody will want to have their say about tuition fees. It's going to open a whole national debate, and she will never win that debate, because Jeremy Corbyn can just say, let's have free fees and let's scrap fees, and that sounds a much better policy than to students, particularly than all this complex sort of rejigging of the system. So it's hard to see how Theresa May is going to win out of this.
Final thoughts on the year ahead as you're covering this?
Do we have to keep talking about tuition fees for another year, really?
I think the answer to that question is yes, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is kind of like slightly depressing that this, I mean, within weeks of the kind of last review and the decision to go to 9K, you could see every university charging 9K. And part of Theresa May's speech yesterday was this idea that we were going to have a competitive tuition fee system with variable fees didn't work out. And to say that 8 years after everyone knew that was the case, I mean, it is slightly kind of depressing, really, in a way. But hopefully, if they can come up, like Jack says, with a political fix that they need, in other words, change the language, change the system so that it is maybe more like Australia's and you don't have this sticker price debt problem that's just always, there's always a row about them. Maybe they can sort it out.
Yeah, just a final thought from me is just to come back to the issue of part-time and mature students. I think, yeah, I certainly agree with what everyone said about the sort of questions about, do we actually need a review, or actually do we just need someone to take a political decision? On part-time and mature, I think, you know, across, you know, large parts of the sector, people realise there's a massive problem there, that tuition fee loans are not working for that part of the potential student population. And, you know, I think there'd be widespread support in the sector, or at least, you know, enthusiasm to take a close look at this issue, and widespread support if there was a solution which did offer some help in that area.
Great. Thanks for joining me today, guys.
No problem.
Good luck in the next year covering this topic.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.